On behalf of the China Journal of Democracy, we are pleased to introduce MD Moinul Haque, the Chairman and Associate Professor of Political Science at Jagannath University, Dhaka, Bangladesh. He is also a research fellowship recipient at the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, ICNC, Washington, D.C. In this interview, Dr. Haque shares insights on the 2024 student-led movement in Bangladesh, which resulted in the collapse of Hasina regime that had ruled the country for 15 years.
Thank you so much for joining me, Lynn.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's so nice to talk to you today.
Same here, yeah.
I did some study on the Bangladeshi movement in 2024. So I have a little bit knowledge about that, but not so deep. So it's really good to invite you to talk to me about this topic. I feel so happy. Now, so as I said, I want to start from the quota, right? So the quota system, I think it might be a good starting point because our audience did not know much about the very first reason why this movement started. Can you give us an overview about this quota system? I want to start from the point when the Supreme Court made a decision about the quota system. But before we start, I really want you to give me an overview about this quota system.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. First of all, well, I am not that much expert on this, but since it's a remarkable event in Bangladesh witnessed recently, so as a student of political science, I also keep interest to on these issues. And likewise, you studied and I also studied a glimpse of this phenomena. So from that point of view, I would say that this civil service BCS quota system actually reserve a percentage of government jobs, as you might know, for specified demographic categories in our country. Most controversially, you would see that 30% for descendants of the 1971 Liberation War Freedom Fighters. This system actually traces back to 1972, immediate after our independence movement, and that then government under the leadership of Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, as you know, that he used this quota as a tool of nation building, national integration, saying that, well, we will honor people, those who sacrificed for our independence, and ensuring, and we will ensure that their families were not left behind in post-war construction. Reconstruction. So out of this point, the then government actually introduced this quota system. But over the years, this quota system has undergone with various political manipulation, and it actually gave birth to politics of injustice, politics of inequality, which resulted and culminated in the 2024, as you know. So if we look at the recent linkage of that quota system to 1924 as a breeding as a catalytic factor of 2024 student movement, we would see that the government's official narrative for restoring the quota in 2024 was legal because as you know that Supreme Court's High Court Division had on 5th of June 2024 reinstated the quota on the grounds that Aumilik's 2018 executive abolition was out of hires. That means it's meaning that the government in 2018 had no power to unilaterally override a statutory scheme.
Okay.
appellate court accordingly restored it in 2024 mm-hmm. on this reading, actually. The government was simply complying with the judicial order.
Okay.
But critics, however, don't, you know, they were arguing that this quota policy was very different. The quota decades, you know, over the decades, this 56% of government posts were allocated to various quota categories and leaving only 44% for merit candidates. And oh. as you know that, only 44% for merit, so you will get a government job, only 44% of person will get job through merit, but 56% will go without merit. So this oh. gave a contradictory, narrative. This posits a contradictory narrative in case of the proper distribution of mm. government jobs and allocation of government jobs. So, mm. and now this has become politicized. Many political, many students of university students actually shout to, remove this quota system completely from this and this provision. And the government in 2024 again reinstated that 2018 quota allocation. And as a result, this conflict again came into surface. And then what we have seen already from a quota yes. demand to a demand of resignation of a prime minister.
Yes, and this. Yeah. Fairly short time, within 2 months.
Yes, within very short time, yes.
Yes, right. Yes. Thank you for the introduction. And then I want to know the triggering event for which the movement was launched. I think that started from a university student's death, right, being shot. Can you give us a little bit of background about that?
Yeah. So as you see that after reinstating the quota on 5th of July,
yes.
And then students started to mobilize campus-based mobilization. So they were very confined within campus periphery, campus premises. And actually the movements radicalized, and the movement's radicalization can be traced back to one single statement. As you know, it was very much aired in different national and international media on 14th of July. In 2024, when our Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina publicly dismissed the protesters as grandchildren of Rajakars. So this statement seems to the protesters as very provocative, and it was like, this was like, what would I say, is a defamation of our new generation. Mm. For example, the grandchild of Rajakar, the term Rajakar or collaborators, actually we use it to refer to the people who aided the Pakistani military during 1971 genocide. Oh. So in a country where the liberation war constitutes the founding myth of national identity, this was not merely an insult, calling a students, a protesters, a grandchildren of Rajakar. This is not merely an insult. Mm. It was an accusation of treason against a generation that had been born decades after 1971. So I think this was the primary triggering, and the statement of the Prime Minister directly hit a student generation, and they felt it as insulting remark. So as a result, as we see that immediate after that remark, many students from a student hostel of Dhaka University and other university came out and chanted protest and slogans, saying like, who are you, who I am, Rajakar, Rajakar, and who said autocrat. So autocrat is Sheikh Hasina. So at that time, student started to label Sheikh Hasina as an autocrat.
Okay.
Yeah, and then within 48 hours, clashes between protesters and the government student wing called Chhatra League, they turned violent to student protesters. And as you know that on 16th of July, Abu Said, a student of Rangpur University of English Department, he was shot dead. And this actually galvanized the movement's cause. I mean, students got a real purpose that they had to fight back since their fellows and their protest brothers and sisters are getting died on the face of severe repression of government law enforcement agencies, including a student wing of government, Chhatro League. At that time, this sparked discontent among not only among students, generally students, but also it sparked and is among many many sectors of the people. As we see that the death of student activist Abu Saeed captured video and circulated on social media. To my view, students and other audience or other people started to see this as a moral shock that massively amplified the participation. So you see the emotion that leveraged the protest mobilization actually gave a triggering factor to launch this movement in a widespread a movement against Sheikh Hasina. And later on, we also see that government, to curb this protest movement, the government initiated curfew and internet shutdown in late July, which paradoxically further radicalized the movement. As you know that when students were cut off from all of the internet communication and other media devices, then students got furious. And this is also another sparkling factor of that movement.
Yeah, thank you very much. And you just now talked about the curfew and then students went on social media. But I know that the government also blocked the students from using social media, especially Facebook and Twitter. So how did the students make their way to still go on social media and mobilize others?
Well, that's a tricky, you know, I talked because I was also conducted an interview with some protest activists, and then they actually used VPN.
VPN, okay.
VPN. They used VPN to go on online communication. And, you know, when the government totally shut down the internet line, broadband internet line, then some students used the small mobile to keep communication among them. So they didn't use a smartphone, rather they used button phone. You know, the button phone, the old button phone, mobile, Nokia mobile, you know?
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so only
but
for
they
texting,
have to know
messaging.
Each other's telephone numbers in that way.
Yeah, they had their telephone number. For example, if my close friend, and they were very close friend, all this Nahid Islam, Sarji Salam, other activists who are very close friends, right?
Okay.
So they know each other's room number, they know each other's mobile number, yeah? So when they shifted to on that button phone to use communications. So that's an interesting thing that I came to know when government actually shut down all this Facebooking app and everything. So they tried to communicate through messages and calling, direct call. That's how they actually
I was wondering why the government did not intercept their telephone calls. Like, for example, in China, the government is robust in intercepting people's phone calls.
Yeah, I think, of course, it was a smart repression. So government actually took the control of media and optical fiber and other accessories that runs the system of internet system. But I think government had missed to control this, mobile network.
Yes.
Because government was not that much prepared that this kind of storm is coming, you know.
Okay.
So consultant of government government officials told them that, well, for now, please stop the social media or internet, cut down the internet line, and then they will not go that much viral. So the government immediately did it, but they, I think they forgot to cancel the mobile network of okay. this button phone.
Okay, I see.
That okay. might be one reason.
Yeah, that is very smart move, I think, for the students. I want to know the military's role, because I know that in the beginning, the military also joined, like the police, also the government-led student organization and border guard. Mm-hmm. So they joined them, but then the military changed. So what made this change happen?
Well, I think military have witnessed, military is very closely linked with Bangladesh politics, and this political protest movement, military is an integral part. And I think after 1990, yes. Military took this kind of chance to be affiliated in politics. Because, you know, immediate after 75, military took over the church. So Bangladesh ran under military for 15 years. But, you know, military run cannot prevail because of international pressure. So military did not actually want to take over the control directly. As you know that in 2006 and 7, the government, which we call military-backed caretaker government, and military also know that if we take direct control of the state, then we will lose our connection from international power. So this is one kind one point that military wanted not to take over the state affairs, rather they will tacitly support the protest movement. So yes, you are right that military behavior was the decisive variable in the uprising outcome.
Yes.
After initially deploying to maintain order, you will see that Bangladesh Army, headed by Wakarudjaman, he refused to escalate mass lethal violence against civilians, and he publicly told that we don't shoot at civilians; it is not in our culture. Mm. So this comment means that military don't want to, you know, catch up the government power. But it is very, very, open that it is very much open that this government, interim government, was formed under the auspices of military. And
yes.
Military head, Wakarudjaman, actually negotiated with many political parties, and then they had, they actually worked behind the scheme, And another reason that military actually did not want to take the power because of some structural restraint. That is, Bangladesh is the world's largest contributor to United Nations peacekeeping missions. You know that, and a source of enormous prestige and financial income of officers come from UN mission. So mass killing of civilians would have triggered immediate UN sanctions.
Oh, okay.
And that might end peacekeeping participation. So it will really does not go with the interest of military, because military don't want to lose this chance to send their troops into United Nations mission. And another factor was that General Walker himself, despite being Hasina's distant relative by marriage, Hasina was Wakarudjaman maybe was Hasina's cousin, something like that, or Wakarudjaman married Hasina's cousin or something like that. I forgot the relationship, but they have some relation. They are related by marriage. Yes, and interestingly, see, being the relative of Hasina, Wakarudjaman prioritized the military's long-term legitimacy over short-term loyalty. Yeah, so Wakarudjaman didn't choose short-term loyalty. I mean, he didn't want to support Hasina because he want military to keep more intact and out of he want to keep military out of, you know, polemics of this politics or this power grab things, right?
Mm.
So unlike 1975 and 82,
mm.
there was no faction within the military that saw a coup as strategically beneficial. So that's the point what I mentioned at the onset, that military did not actually want to repeat to repeat this phenomena.
Mm.
So that might be the reason that military only, you know, only showed allegiance or obedience to the people rather than to the government.
That's great insight. Can I say that this military is very different from the previous, partly because of the leader, right? I think the leader, even though as the cousin of Hasina, maybe has his own independent value that probably would allow him to stand along the side of the students.
Yes, you are right. And I think, as you know, that this, the Waqar Zaman actually recently joined as a head of the military, 23rd of June, maybe.
Yes.
He assumed the head of the military. And he thought that, well, I just take over as a general, and now this, acid test is in front of me. So what should I do? That's why I think he did not push himself into more controversial politics again. So he preferred to be remain aloof from this kind of takeover politics. That might be one reason. Yeah.
Okay.
And yes, definitely he has some vision to put the country on right track, on democratic track. Otherwise, he could intervene easily. He had every incentives that could exploit all the state power at that time. But he actually did not pay attention to that state capture politics. Mm.
I think that's really decisive point. If we see today's Myanmar, the military took power, and the military, especially the military leader, right, becomes the sham president. So that is very different. And that's why I was thinking about, you know, the kind of loop. You have military coup, you have movement, you have new government, and then again, you come back to military coup, the same thing. This happened with Myanmar, and I was thinking, until last year, I was thinking that the future of Bangladesh may still be uncertain, mm-hmm. because if the military take the power, especially I think the military at the beginning, they wanted to form the kind of interim government. So I was thinking, so it seems like going back to the loop again. So now what you say is that the military is new military, but then how can a government like Hasina promote a person that is actually at odds with herself?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one interesting thing is that this military, the same military facilitated Hasina to flee from Bangladesh to India. Actually, they arranged all the, all these protocol so that Hasina can safely, go to India. Yes. Military could actually arrest her as in-house arrest, like in Myanmar,
yeah.
Right? But military did not do it. Military wanted to let Hasina escape freely, and then they tried to reconstruct the country. I mean, they then started dialogue with many political parties to fill the void, since there was no government. So immediately the military contacted with many political actors, and including Dr. Muhammad Yunus. So
yes.
They invited Dr. Muhammad Yunus to come to country and to take over the charge.
Mm-hmm.
And in consultation with the political party and the main protesters of July movement, Nahid Islam, Sarji Salom, and Asnat Abdullah. So they actually wanted that a person who has international reputation like Muhammad Yunus. So they requested Muhammad Yunus to take over the charge as head of interim. So military actually facilitated this transition, I would say. So it is one kind of military-led transition.
Another party that I think is also playing a very key role in this movement, that is the BNP. I don't know at that time what kind of specific role BNP play.
Well, thank you. This is quite interesting question, and many people ask this question because BNP was remained silent long time, and then all of a sudden this 2024 came, and now the question is who reaped the benefit of this movement, right? Yes. And suddenly BNP pop up on the screen, and yes. claiming that this is our movement, this is our movement. We led the movement for 15 years under Sheikh Hasina's dictatorial rule. Yes. And I would say that, yes, BNP's move BNP was actually occupied an uncomfortable and strategic shrewd position. Shrewd position in a sense that, yes, they were supportive enough to benefit from the uprising success. Mm. At the same time, restrained enough to avoid, contaminating it with its controversial history. Because, BNP was really away from politics, grassroots politics, because under Hasina, many leaders were systematically jailed and imprisoned.
Yes.
And Hasina banned rallies of BNP's political rallies, and its supporters were harassed. Khaled Abia, their leader. She herself had been sentenced to prison on corruption charges, widely seen as politically motivated. And in the early stage, BNP's members participated in solidarity events, but the party's leadership correctly assessed that the direct involvement would allow Hasina to reframe the movement as party-backed movement. So BNP actually did not want that Hasina, came over them saying that, well, BNP, you are manufacturing this dissent, so we will again charge on you. So, so thinking this way, BNP was thinking that, well, we will cautiously move on this movement. And and after 5th of August, the BNP's strategy shifted decisively, and it immediately began demanding elections and seeking to catch in on the anti-Awami League wave before public sentiment could be redirected. Because BNP thought that, well, now this time we will capitalize this public sentiments to come into our vote bank, right? So that people give us vote. And because BNP actually, immediate after the 2024 movement, BNP tried to convince the people that election is the only guarantee to restore Bangladesh in a democratic way. So they started to reap benefit along the electoral politics, this is very interesting. And BNP suddenly wanted to take advantage of this mass support into their vote bank.
Thank you for this analysis.
And I think BNP is successful. I think BNP is successful in this regard, since they have won 2009 seats out of 2099. It's a landslide victory.
Surely, yes. Now, again, I want to go back a little bit to the quota system. The quota system allowed 30% of the descendants of the freedom fighters, right, to take the government positions. I was wondering, who were these descendants? Were they only the descendants from Awami League, or were they also descendants from BNP, or solely from Awami League?
So you want to know who are the descendants, right?
Yes.
So, the descendants are the grandchildren of the war veteran, or the Mukti Jodha, we call freedom fighters.
Yes.
So, but it is very irony that now we will not find any grandchild of the after 70 years, you will not find any grandchildren. But still, there is a movement among the people of freedom fighters that, no, we are grandchildren and we are the relative of the grandchildren. So in this way, they want to make themselves lively. They say that in this connection, since my granddaughter, my grandfather was a freedom fighters. So I also belong to a family of freedom fighters. So I have the right to get this quota. Mm. So in this way, these descendants came into action, you know.
Okay. Were some of, I don't know, were some of the descendants actually descendants of the BNP members, or they are mostly descendants of Awami League members?
Well, actually, you know, in our country, people are politically divided into two camps.
Yes.
For example, one camp is pro-independence group, which is headed by Awami League, and another is post-Bangladeshi nationalist, which is led by BNP. You see? So the people who actually were adhere to pro-independence category, they are affiliated with Awami League. Yeah? And then Awami League thinks that if we recruit any descendants or any grandchildren of freedom fighters, they will work for us. And as a result, most of the, you know, government jobs and government positions are filled by these people who actually favors Awami League and pro independence ideology. In this way, you know, Awami League wanted this, you know, Awami League actually, you know, it was they were trying to instill a kind of nationalistic ideology or nationalistic fervor among the people, so that people always support Awami League as a party in power.
Oh, I see.
Here lies the politics. Yeah.
Okay. And I think there is a sharp conflict in values. One side want meritocracy and the other side want like the identity, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so I understand this is a conflict between the students and the government. But how about BNP?
BNP actually gave tacit support to students, but because BNP was also trying to offer some alternative to Awami League ideology, right? So, BNP was thinking that, well, Awami League is capitalizing most of the people with this quota benefits or incentives. Mm. So we have nothing to offer to our new generation. That's why BNP was trying to dismantle this kind of, you know, regime.
Okay.
So that if the students don't go to Awami League and instead they join BNP.
So that's why
BNP was trying to, you know, provoke students to make this a real issue, that quota is discriminatory and quota doesn't honor the talent of the students. So don't go for quota and instead go for merit. So, you know, so this contradictory merit vs quota, that was the, you know, that was the banner of protest, merit versus quota. Yeah.
Yes.
So BNP was in support of merit, you know.
And also another interesting thing is that even though I understand BNP leaders encounter persecution, but still BNP survived. I mean, for so many years, it's 15 years at least, right? So how come a government would allow opposition party to still be present all the time?
Well, this is interesting. Well, there are many hearsay in a sense that many BNP leaders tried to make some negotiations with Awami League top leaders so that they don't be exterminated from the country or they don't be sent to jail.
Yes.
So there was some hidden negotiation behind the scene. And as such, they used to survive in this way. But they were not in any heading position. I mean, they were on the surface, but their role remained, you know, reluctant. So they were just normally doing politics. They are organizing some, you know, soft type of political action, protest, but they were not that much, harmful to Awami League. And since they were not harmful, So I only let them to function.
Oh, I see.
And then when they deem that they are doing some harm, they send to jail. So many top leaders frequently were sent to jail.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
Okay. Oh,
this is how it worked. Yeah, this is how it worked.
Yeah. So I guess Hasina also wants to present like a democratic like image,
yeah.
Right? So that's why
yes, you're
she
right.
Allowed...
Because she continued election and
yes.
she believed in electoral transfer of power. That's why she held regular elections. So it was a competitive authoritarianism. For example, she believed in election, but once she came into power, she started to violate all the principles and promises that she made during the election.
Mm.
So it was a competitive authoritarianism, I would say.
Mm.
It is not purely democratic, not purely autocratic, but in middle, it's a gray zone, you know?
Yeah. Another interesting thing is that we know that the students' movement actually led to the collapse of Awami League or Hasina's power.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we talk about the new election, why BNP leaders took the office rather than the student leaders? So this is also an intriguing question to me.
Well, I think skills to, you know, skills that makes a revolution possible. I mean, you might have a skill to run a revolution, but it is not necessary that skill will give you leverage to win elections.
Mm.
That same has happened in the Bangladesh case. For example, BNP was much more, you know, organized in electoral politics than the protesters who actually, you know, led the revolution, right?
Mm.
So, for example, the NCP,
yes.
the National Citizen Party, that formed in February 2025, immediate after the revolution, they barely had 12 months before the election and had no national organization.
Oh.
They had no campaign structure in that way. And they have no patronage network. They have no local candidates with name recognition across 2099 constituencies. Yeah, but BNP had is and BNP spent 15 years, right? And and people know that BNP as a leading and one of the second largest political party in Bangladesh. So BNP has that reputation. So, you know, despite the fact that, and it is true that the mobilized, the ousting of Sheikh Hasina was due to the student protest,
yes.
but the fruits of this revolution goes to BNP, because BNP is already a prepared political party. They has grassroots organization and leader is structure. But that's why you see BNP owned 2009 seats, whereas
yes.
NCP owned only 3 seats in 39 constituencies. So it shows that winning a election requires more skills than winning authoritarian regime and winning against authoritarian regime. You see, so electoral politics is different from, politics of protest, right?
Yes, that's right. Now, we talk about democratic movement and also democracy. I was wondering if now Bangladesh is in democracy or not, but BNP right now is the party in power. Do they encounter opposition at this moment? Because I think Awami League is already out. There are like two, usually it's like two, right? So one is the party in power, another is the opposition. So what is the current party in opposition to the current BNP?
Well, as we see that in the parliament, the real opposition is Jamaat Islam and their co-collaborator NCP, National Citizen Party. As you know that during forming the government, BNP was the largest party in the parliament at the moment. And Jamaat and NCP joined together. So they are acting as an opposition of the party. And as you know, that Awami League is out of this scheme. So they are banned and under legal charges.
Yeah.
I don't know whether these charges will be lifted so soon, but it is a matter of a legal process. So we will not count Awami League as an opposition at the moment.
Oh,
and,
okay.
Well, opposition, as we know, the Jamaat, who remained out of power for the last 50 years, they have come, this is their first time that many of Jamaat's political officials have taken seats in the national parliament.
Oh, okay.
And this is their remarkable opportunity to show the citizens that we are your true representatives.
Mm.
And if we, I am watching sometime the parliament session over media, and I am watching that they are very much soft while criticizing the government, and they are not creating any barrier for functioning of the government. The recent example is that recently, you know, Bangladesh is suffering severely with energy crisis. And then Jamaat themselves offered the government to form a commission to find out the loopholes of energy crisis and the way out. And this is, and the government readily responded, Jamaat, that yes, we will form a commission combining both opposition party and party in government.
Oh.
So this is one kind of development that we are seeing in Bangladesh, which is quite uncommon, that opposition party actually hail government party, government party in power. But in this case, I think Jamaat is acting a quite positive role as an opposition party. And if this continues, I think the scheme of opposition party that remained tainted by previous political parties will be reduced to some extent, and a new type of opposition party politics will take into drive.
Yes, so how would you anticipate the future of Bangladesh?
This question really is an empirical question, and if I would like to answer this question, I must first think about how do we view democracy.
Yes.
Are we thinking democracy is something that depends on electoral outcome only or election only? So if it is so, then I think Bangladesh is now in right track, because Bangladesh, for after a long time, Bangladesh had a credible election, and which is overwhelmed by many international observers. And they said that in its history, in its recent history, since 2008, Bangladesh witnessed three fair, credible elections. So this is a good sign for democracy, right?
Mm.
Because we see many political actors behave democratically. There were very less killings, less fighting among political parties that we have witnessed in the previous era.
Mm.
And this election in 2026, we see less casualties, less death, and less confrontation between political parties. So in this sense, if we think democracy as an electoral way, electoral political is perspectives, then yes, it is a good sign that Bangladesh democracy will be flourishing. And of course, you will see that for the first time, you know, the July Charter, through this election, there was another referendum, right? And this referendum, 60% people voted for new for a change or reform Bangladesh. I mean Bangladesh reforms, and you see that 60% of voters voted for referendum, and we believe that if the NP actually follow or obey all this referendum in their tenure, then the promises in this referendum they've made, Bangladesh will really came out as a accountable government, and free of there are a lot of I think you have read the referendum, right? So
yes.
It is said that there will be the prime minister tenure will be two times, and there will be free judicial system, and corruption anti-corruption commission, independent anti-corruption commission, all all things signals to good governance indicators, right? So if we think that this referendum can be implemented by the tenure of within the tenure of BNP government, so I'm very optimistic that Bangladesh will find a new democratic governance system. But there are some structural risks, I think, because you know the winner takes all culture. The winner takes all culture of Bangladesh politics, in which ruling class all try to manipulate the power and they try to manipulate media, bureaucracy, and police that Sheikh Hasina did, has not been dismantled. It is still exercising, you know? I don't get that. It is still exercising. The BNP, BNP carries its own history. As we know, that BNP is not a, you know, is not a saint political party. They had infamous history of corruption and you know, good governance failure, right? So if and Jamaat and NCP opposition has sometimes boycotted BNP swearing, and also Jamaat and Jamaat and BNP now now shouting for effectiveness of this referendum.
Okay.
But BNP is trying not to implement referendum overnight. They want time. But I don't know how long Jamaat and NCP will keep silent if BNP don't take any further initiative to implement referendum. So the clash between NCP and Jamaat and BNP will likely to occur in recent future, I guess, if the question of referendum doesn't settle.
Okay.
Yeah? So
okay.
I am quite optimistic. At the same time, I have some, you know, risk. Pessimism. And also, last point. Let me add my last point. And I am also quite. I'm afraid whether the BNP can overcome the authoritarian equilibrium trap.
Yes.
I mean, a situation, as you know, that ruling party uses state power to entrench itself, making peaceful alternation only possible through crisis. I don't know whether BNP can actually do this. So maybe when BNP, at some point, BNP might need to take back authoritarian mantle. Under the guise of democratic democratic government. I don't know. Bangladesh. Anything can happen in Bangladesh at the moment.
Actually, I'm quite curious. How can the students, I mean, at that time in 2024, in very short time, mobilize one another in such a large scale? I mean, I don't believe they had prior organization. I think they do not have this kind of preparation. How could they mobilize all of a sudden with so many people to participate in this movement?
Yes, you are right. They had no previous political affiliation per se, and they had no political position, mainstream political position, but they were intricately connected with social media. Yes, that so networked, so it was a network movement, I would say.
So
in this network movement, you will get some facilities. For example, you can connectly quickly connected with your peers. For example, in Bangladesh, most of the mobilizations occurs in university area, and university has some advantages. You know why? Because they live in a student hostel, and a student hostel are situated very closely proximated area. So students can easily communicate in person, or also they are highly connected with Facebook and Instagram and other social media. So this is how they you know, got viral, and they got a connection with their peers. And at the same way, this Facebook actually triggers most to connect students within very short time.
I think that is also very important for Chinese, because Chinese are facing the same challenges. especially with the networking.
So I would say, this type of movement, like 2024, this has some linkage with the movement 2013, Shahabad movement, as you know that. This Shahabad movement was organized in a very quick moment, and it was very much widespread movement, and it was the first non-violent civil resistance in Bangladesh, what I would say, because I did my PhD on this topic. Shahabad was my field study. So I showed in my PhD that Shahabad was the biggest instance of civil resistance where students and other sectors of people broadly participated, and they used precisely non-violent tactics. And these non-violent tactics actually gave impetus to students to mobilize widely and in great numbers. So when a movement is organized in non-violent way, it is more likely that the students and the movement get phenomenal.
Can you further elaborate a little bit for this?
Yes. So non-violence is a technique of contention. It is not like pacifist way of sitting one area and demand change. Non-violence is you act against the government or authority not by using force, but by using some tactics. For example, you throw flowers to your opponents, whereas your opponents put gun onto you, but they are not legitimate. They will not fire on you because you are not provoking them. You are throwing flowers to them. So flowers cannot be replaced by bullets, right? So this is one technique, non-violent way. So you are singing on the face of your opponents, and this singing actually makes resonance to hundreds of pupils, and this make a cohort, is a solidarity chord. So when other people listen to this music and they also feel excited, And then they come to the same place to show their allegiance to the movement. So these non-violent tactics, sit-in, demonstration, protest, slogans. For example, this slogan: who said it? Who said it? Autocrat, autocrat. Who are we? Who are we? Rajakar, Rajakar. Only this slogan actually provocated all spheres of people, and people got outburst listening that what Hasina is telling us, Rajakar, no way, we will fight better, right? So this slogan is entirely a non-violent tools. It's not a violent tools, right? So this kind of non-violent techniques actually make this movement more phenomenal, and this is the one precise reason that many people attracted to this non-violent movement, and this is how the base of the protest against Hasina actually drew from these non-violent protest techniques.
Yeah, so to my understanding, this kind of non-violent tactics is trying to avoid escalation from the government side, because they have no reasons to escalate, right?
Yes, they have no reason to escalate violence against these protesters.
Yeah, so even if they do, they cannot severely punish them. I think in Hong Kong 2019, the protesters also developed their own songs, right? And these songs is also a protest song. Now, these protest songs, even if, for example, people sing, the government just want to stop them from singing, but they cannot really put them in jail for many years just because they sing a song, right?
Yeah, right. And also with this, also strategic leadership. These movements are characterized as leaderless movement. You don't find any concrete leader. So they are all leaders. They are all leaders. You don't find any locus of leadership center. So this is one kind of strategy that these protest movements actually follow. So this leaderless movement, network movement, and non-violent tactics, all this together makes this protest against Hasina successful.
Yes. So there's one thing that's very interesting. So the strategy is to be leaderless, to make the movement leaderless, so that everybody will be relatively safe, right? But then when we move to, after success, then because the student movement is leaderless, then no one is going to really have the influence during the elections. So that actually means that if you are the leader or de facto, one of the de facto leaders in the movement, you are not going to be a national leader only because you are the leader of a movement, right?
Yes.
So there is a kind of, I mean, for the people who want to seek power, there's a kind of dilemma in this, right? So you want to lead the movement to success, but after success, you are not going to be influential. So that means you are not going to be the leader of the nation. Is that the reason why the students, I mean, I was also thinking why the student leaders cannot be elected as the national leaders? Is this one of the reasons?
Well, you know, this question also struck me because I have read many literature about Bangladeshi student protest movement and student leaders.
Yes.
And during 1952, language movement students, you know, laid a good effort in it. And in 1990s, that led to democracy in our country. Student leaders also, contributed a lot. And during 2013 and 2024 onwards, student actually led the vehicle of this movement. But this time, first in our history, that student leaders turned into political elite. Political activists, political elites, because three student leaders are now in the cabinet. So they were elected as a representative of the country. Never seen in Bangladeshi history that the student leaders paid so much effort, but they did not get any any seats in the parliament. But this is the first time that this 2024 movement facilitated students. Students to become politicians. You know, they are now representative of the national parliament. That means they have turned from activists to politicians, right?
Yes.
So until 2024, they were merely acting as a political activist. They were not political representatives, right? And now we have seen three student leaders as a political representative. So this is one innovation in student politics, I would say. And now if this continue to follow, then I think student politics will really bring some good fruit for Bangladeshi democracy. Because you should not do politics out of nothing. You should you must have some goal that you should be a visionary leader, right? And this protest movement give you that channel.
Yes.
Channel that roots to become a political leaders, right? And this is the first time in Bangladesh that we have seen these roots have effectively paid.
That's wonderful. So I think the outcome of 2024 movement is win-win-win. For DMP is big win, but for Jamaat it's also win, right? And for students,
definitely. And the student politics itself, it's a win-win.
For some of the student activists, I mean, in China, back in China, people may think that we just want to be the national leaders. Actually, it is not so realistic. But if you think of this way, that you can enter politics, becoming one of the political elites, that's already a pathway to your future political leadership.
Yeah,
rather
you
than
right.
you... lead the movement and then you become the national leader. I think this may be myth in the activists today.
Yes, you are right. And this phenomena also gave us hope for many other countries. For example, in Nepal, many student activists are becoming representative of the National Assembly, you know?
Yeah.
So, and this trend is growing nowadays.
Okay.
So students are much more interested in street politics and street education rather than classroom education. So Bangladesh is one prominent example how street classroom. Students are interested in street classroom.
This is enlightening, actually, to many people still in struggle. Thank you so much. Yeah, I think it's really, I really appreciate your insight and a lot of knowledge. I hope our audience will also be very interested in you. So I really feel grateful for your sharing of all these insights. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lily. Thank you, Lily. It was really very insightful discussion with you, and you know a lot of history about Bangladesh, and thank you for your interest about Bangladesh and considering me to talk in this occasion. And we will keep in touch.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
See you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.